Welcome to the Sim Cafe, a podcast produced by the team at Innovative Sim Solutions. Join our host, Deb Tauber, as she sits down with subject matter experts from across the globe to redefine clinical education and the use of simulation. So pour yourself a cup of relaxation, sit back, tune in, and learn something new from the Sim Cafe. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions or positions of anyone at Innovative Sim Solutions or our sponsors. Thanks to Iris Health Solutions Limited for sponsoring this week's podcast. Iris is a scenario design platform which makes it really easy to design, set up, and run great scenarios in line with recognized best practice. Iris makes co-design and sharing of scenarios simple, and the library and review ensure one high-quality version is always maintained. You can also join the Iris Fair Share community and access, reuse, or repurpose over 700 scenarios from colleagues around the world with IP always recognized. The new Iris Mini Sim Wizard allows quick and easy scenario creation for simpler sims such as in situ, primary care, and paramedic.
Hi, welcome to the Sim Cafe. Today, we welcome our first guest, Dr. Kim Layton. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Dr. Layton. Dr. Kim Layton is the executive director of ITCON Clinical Simulation and Innovation Center at Hamad Medical Center Corporation in Doha, Qatar, serving the multidisciplinary practitioner community. Kim is the past president of the International Nursing Association for Clinical Simulation and Learning, where she led development of the first standards of best practice, now in its fourth edition. She is currently on the board of directors for the Society for Simulation and Healthcare. Dr. Layton's research focuses on development and psychometric analysis evaluation tools for simulation education, which have been disseminated through her website to simulationists in 82 countries. Her current work explores the effectiveness of various clinical education environments. Dr. Layton is co-editor of the award-winning book, Simulation Champions, Fostering Courage, Caring, and Connection. And Dr. Layton, we are so honored to have you as our first guest. Thank you so much. And I've personally known Dr. Layton for 10 years, and it's just, you know, it's been a great relationship. She's always been served as a resource and mentor to me. Thank you.
Well, thanks. This is my first podcast, so I'm excited and I'm honored to be here with you today.
Great.
10 years. 10 years we've known each other already?
Yes. Because I started at Chamberlain in, well, maybe not quite 10 years, but.
No, probably. Because I was there 7 years and I've been gone almost three. So,
Wow.
Time flies. Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you, but the first question is, tell me a little bit about your journey in simulation, a little bit about your career and your past.
Yeah, so I'm a nurse by background, most of it emergency room nursing with a few other things scattered in there. But I moved to education in 2001, and I was doing beginning clinical students in a diploma program, which I loved because it's just so much fun to have the students that first time they give a shot, the first time they give even an enema, they're like, I can't wait to call my mom and tell my dad that. But I worked in a really great program in Nebraska. And one day the president of the university came in my, it was College of Nursing, came in my office and she said, how would you like to go to Florida for a week? I'm like, well, it's January in Nebraska. Yes, sure. That would be great. Thanks. And she went on her merry way. And then a couple hours later, I tracked her down and I'm like, what is it that you'd like me to do in Florida? She said, well, I want you to go check out this human patient simulator and come back and tell me whether we should buy it or not. And she said, I have the money for it. She had been fundraising for 7 years and she had the money, but she wasn't sure if she should buy it. So off to Florida I went, and the first night I was there, I called her and I'm like, write the check, because this thing is amazing. It's amazing. So she did. And in March, we got it. So that was the month after the conference. So then she's like, okay, I'm going to put you in charge of it. And I'm like, okay. She said, well, you're the expert. I'm like, wow, the bar is really low. Because at that point in time, all you needed to be for an expert was to know what a human patient simulator was. So I asked her a couple of years later, I said, why did you choose me? She said, well, because I felt like you could convince the faculty that it was a good thing, which turned out to be a really good thing, because the facility wasn't ready for it, right? The faculty really wanted, that was a lot of money. And the faculty had a lot of other ideas on where that money could be spent. So it was a little tough getting it started at first, but you know, once people saw the power of simulation, you know, I just brought them in and I created scenarios that matched their course objectives, brought them in, they were the learners, and every time they left, they were like, oh, we could do this. Oh, let's do that. Oh, why don't we try this? And honestly, it sold itself to the faculty. It was not difficult at all. So
can I just ask you one question? Yeah. So what year was that?
That was in 2003.
Yep.
Yeah. So that was before there were simulation organizations. There were no books. There were no journals. And the closest school that had one was in Kansas City. So that was about a 3.5 hour drive away.
You were a true pioneer.
Yeah, and I think that's why, honestly, why networking has been so important to the simulation community since the very start, because that's how we all learned it, was by calling people and visiting, and those folks in Kansas City who are now, you know, such close friends, they welcomed me, you know, come on down, spend a few days with us. We'll show you what we do. And, you know, if you like it, you can do it at your school. And it was quite an adventure. It was.
What simulator did you guys get? What was the first one that you had?
We had the Medi, which is now CAE Healthcare. We had the Medi HPS. So it was $218,000.
Wow.
I know, which was, wow. You know, honestly, for a diploma nursing program, it was a massive amount of money.
Wow. But
Phyllis, who is our president, love her to death. She's so creative. So every year she had a silent auction and a fashion show. And so the doctors and nurses and their families from the hospital would dress up in the latest fashions from the stores in Lincoln, Lincoln's a small city. It was like 250,000 people. And then we would have silent auction items. They were good. Like, you know, they were ski cabins in the Rockies that somebody might have a timeshare. A lot of Nebraska Cornhusker football memorabilia, you know, back in the days where we were better than we are now. And, you know, she seriously raised all that money with fashion shows.
That's amazing. Especially that the date.
Mm-hmm.
So my next question is going to be, what's your favorite story about simulation?
Yeah, I have a couple. They're both really interesting, but I'll tell you this one. You know, all of our nursing students have to know CPR, right? They all have to have their card and they have to have been trained. But I had wondered, just because they have the card, does that mean that they're able to walk into a room where a patient has stopped breathing and perform? And, you know, my gut was telling me the answer to that was no. So, you know, we set up a study, actually, and I put that $218,000 simulator face down on the floor, and I surrounded him with like stuff, all the stuff that you would find on a bedside table, right? Tissues, emesis basin, the big jug, magazines. There was stuff everywhere, between his legs, under his arms. And then I stood in front of the closed door, and when the students knocked to come in, I threw a tray of silverware at the door So then they're trying to get in the room and all they can see is his legs, right? So when they're able to get into the room, we really just wanted to see, can they do the steps of CPR and call for help until the code team arrives? So we had 10 groups and 9 of them could not do that. Only one group performed the steps in the proper order, but it took them a very long time, which, you know, we know to expect that, right? It always takes the learners longer than it takes us because they haven't done it. But one group was particularly bad. I mean, it was really bad. It was hard to watch. It was painful. But we just let it play out. I mean, they reorganized the room. They picked up the things off the floor. They, at some point, they brought the crash cart near the patient, but they really took 9 minutes to start the CPR process. So when we went into the debriefing, we said, well, how did that go? Oh, we did great. We took care of him so fast. It was amazing. We're really proud of ourselves. I'm like, okay, great. I said, well, let's watch the video because I'm so glad we had a recording of this. I said, let's watch the video together. So we sat there and it was painful for them too. And the one student looked at me and she said, this is the nurse I never want to be. And so, you know, we had our debriefing and we went back and we turned them back over again. And we did it again. We did it 2 or 3 more times until they had their confidence back. But the key for me at that point, it was twofold. One was the value of the debriefing and being able to redo it again. And the other was the importance of judicious use of video. I'm not really a fan of using video all the time for everything, but in this case, it helped me to understand that time moved differently for them, right? What I was watching was painfully slow, and for them, it was very fast. And that's always stuck with me. And it's why I always tell people, you have to, when you're planning your scenarios, you probably need to plan for 2 to 3 times the length that you think it should take, because you have to give them time to process what they're seeing and doing.
Excellent story. Do you want to share the other one?
Sure. The other one was, we had a group of students that was just a couple weeks away from graduation. And the scenario was DKA. So it was fairly complex. And again, we had one student. We did small simulation. We did it in groups of 4. And this student, I mean, it was so bad, Deb. The instructor was in the control room with me and we're watching this and our mouths are just hanging open because we're like, what are we going to do? Because now we've seen her inability to manage this patient at even the most basic of levels within that scenario. And we were very aware that she was ready to graduate. And it's like, what are we going to do? So, you know, we had a big meeting with the faculty and, you know, we looked at her grades. We looked at exam grades. We looked at her clinical evals. We even talked about what her plan was for where she was going to work, because she already had a job lined up, and did we feel that she could fulfill that job? And then we went through the debriefing. So this was all happening in the control room, right? Yeah. It was really fast. Then we went through the debriefing and we did a review of the physiology, the pathophysiology, and you could just like see the light bulb go off in her head. She just didn't understand the pathophysiology. And once she got past that, we had her come back with another group on another day and she was just fine. So again, for me, that showed the power of the debriefing and how I think we take some risk when we do evaluation only on their performance in the scenario. Because if we agree that most of the learning takes place in debriefing, then how can we evaluate them before they've had their debriefing? So Yeah, both of those have stuck with me. And that's been, you know, over 15 years ago now. So
great story. Great story. And it speaks to the KSAs, right? Is it a knowledge deficit? Is it a skill or is it an attitude? I think those things are always, you know, here you had a knowledge gap, you filled the gap and you were able to, you know, and honestly, it's my belief that simulation, you start learning when you get the assignment. Yeah. You get the assignment, then you do the pre-briefing, you're learning there, you do the sim, you're learning there, you do the debriefing, learning there. And then even as you carry on with your day, you're thinking about it and learning things from it. Yeah, it's an unbelievable way to learn.
It's so powerful. It's such a powerful learning methodology. It's amazing.
Yes. I'd like to ask you to tell us a little bit about your book and about your passion for evaluations. I just want to let the learners know that if you go to the Innovative Sim Solutions website and you go to the More section under resources, you can see Kim Layton does a little presentation. She's baked into some of the courses that we have. So if you want to know more about evaluation, you can check that too. And she's got multiple resources.
Yeah, the book was the brainchild of Colette Foisy-Dahl. Colette works up in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And so when I worked for Medi years ago, we developed a program for nursing curriculum integration. It had, I think, 26, 25 scenarios, and it came with two consulting visits. So I got to go do consulting at Colette's school. And while I was there, she taught me everything she knew. It was great. I didn't consult for her. She helped me. And we became really good friends at that point in time. So Colette does a ton of consulting at an international level, and she's been all over the world. And so she had this great collection of templates and handouts and agendas and, you know, just so much great stuff. And somebody had told her she should put it in a book and write a book. So I'm like, yeah, Colette, that's a great idea. You should do that. And she's like, well, you should do it with me. And I'm like, okay, why not? So we went to Walters Kluwer in Philadelphia. We got lost on the trains. We had a great day and we signed a contract. And then it was a 2-year process to write the book. It was intense. It was intense. You know, we had many, many authors, over 100 different authors in our book. So being the editors of that book was very rewarding. We wrote it, you know, it was a work of our hearts, I guess. You know, when they told us about royalties, we're like, we'll get paid. We didn't even think about things like that. We just wanted to share with people because we knew that getting started as a novice in simulation was difficult. So we wanted to share. What was the second question, Deb? I'm sorry.
I just wanted to talk about evaluation.
Evaluation. Yeah. So I was doing my PhD. This was in, I don't know, early 2000s. And I had this great plan that I was going to do a dissertation. I was going to do a study on high school principals and superintendents and teachers, I don't remember who else, but it was going to be about doing your dissertation as a group, because we all know that most research is not done by just one person. Most of the time it's done by a group, but in a doctoral program, everybody's expected to do their own individual research. And I thought, well, that seems kind of crazy. So my advisor agreed to it. I got the first 3 chapters written, and then I changed my mind. So at that point, I was involved in simulation. I had originally avoided simulation as a dissertation topic because it was so new to me that I didn't want to get burned out, you know, by trying to figure out how to do simulation all day at work and then studying about it and writing about it at night. But then shortly after that, when I went to work for Medi, they had collected all of the papers that had been written about simulation. So in November of 2004, there were 71 articles written about simulation. That's it, 71. And I had them all.
Wow.
I had them all. And I was in a position where I was being introduced to the people who had written all the work. And I thought, well, this is an opportunity I probably shouldn't let go by. So I called my advisor and I said, hey, I want to switch my topic. And, you know, God love him. He's like, okay, what do you want to do instead? So he suggested a survey. And I'm like, oh, that sounds good because surveys are easy. That's what I thought. I was so wrong. But the result of the dissertation was the Clinical Learning Environment Comparison Survey. And it was designed to compare how well the undergrad nursing students believe their clinical learning needs were met in traditional clinical and in the simulation lab. And so it had really good reliability to it, but it kind of sat unused for a while until the INAXL conference in Vegas at the place where Donnie and Marie have their show, the Flamingo with the pink and white striped walls, Flamingo. And so I was walking down the hall and Jennifer Hayden came up to me. You'll know Jennifer's name from spearheading the National Council of State Boards of Nursing study. And she said, Kim, I hear you have a tool that compares the learning environments. And so I said, yeah. And she said, well, we want to use it for the National Council of State Boards of Nursing study. Where is it published? And I'm like, well, I have not published it. And she said, well, you will now. And so I went home, I wrote the paper, I got it published, and then they used it actually in the National Council study. So that was really exciting. But then it kind of sat unused again. You won't find it very much in the literature until now. Now it's found a new use because research team and I added a third environment, which is the online screen-based simulation environment. And we did this at the beginning of COVID because I really felt it was important to get a snapshot of what we were doing online during COVID. And so it's now the Clex 2.0, the includes screen-based simulation. And when we did that study, screen-based simulation was lower in every single item on the survey. But that really shouldn't be a surprise to us because some instructors had 2 full days to put all their simulation online. Others had to do it over an impromptu spring break, which they did not get a break. In addition to having to do it quickly, it's a different skill set to teach online than it is to do mannequin-based simulation in a lab. And so, you know, we went through this back when we first started with mannequins. We all had a tendency to have the skills lab coordinator. The skills lab instructor was now the new simulation instructor. But when you think about it, skills labs, they're really concrete, right? We have a checklist. And the student has to do that skill in exactly the right order and in exactly the right way. And if they make a mistake, they have to realize it. And sometimes they'll get to do it again, and sometimes they won't. And anyway, so it's so rigid. And then at the end, if they mess up enough things, after 3 times, they fail the course. And for some programs, that means they fail, they have to step out of the program. So it's really high stakes. So we were taking those faculty to the sim lab and say, okay, you can be a simulation facilitator. It's okay for everybody to make mistakes. We'll just try it again. Encourage them to make mistakes and learn from it. And when you think about the difference in expectations between those two environments, it's really challenging for a lot of people. So now you're asking these people who are used to small groups in person in a simulation lab to figure out how to do this hands-on training online. And yeah, you can have 2 days to figure it out. Well, of course, it's not going to work. Of course, the results are not going to be very good. But now we have that data, we have that, and we're using it to support the fact that faculty or facilitator development is key to success. We knew that, but now we've got some data to support that.
Great, great. And Kim, let me just, this will be our final question here. Where do you see the future of simulation going? And I mean, I realize I'm asking you this, you know, I didn't give you a prep you for this. So I'm just curious about what you're thinking is going to happen. And you know, none of us have a crystal ball. None of us could have in a million years would have guessed that COVID would have happened. But now that it's here, and, you know, what are your thoughts on simulation?
Yeah, where will simulation go? I have thought for a while that mannequin-based simulation would become less and less used over time as we figured out how to do virtual reality, augmented reality, mixed reality, online simulation, because of the need for the small groups and because it's expensive. I mean, the mannequin-based companies have done a fantastic job of lowering the price point for their mannequins. And, you know, that was greatly driven by the need to be able to support the nursing programs in the world, because nursing programs historically don't have a lot of money. So, you know, kudos to our colleagues in the mannequin-based and all kinds of simulation for trying to meet our needs. I've heard people say, you know, that in the last year and a half, we've probably moved virtual reality and screen-based sim forward about 10 years worth of time, you know, because it would have just taken us quite a while to figure this out, because everybody wants research to prove that this works and prove that that works. And, you know, nobody had time to do that. We had to get things online because of COVID. COVID's not going to completely go away. And so I think, you know, some of the really good things that happened during COVID is that we were able to prove that simulation could be done online, and in some instances it could be done really well. We still do have a need for faculty development. I think that's really important at this time, but I don't think we're going to completely go back to the old way. I think we'll continue to see mannequin based, but I think we're, you know, the things that worked online, why not keep them online? Why not? It's the same type of thinking, you know, well, we can't replace traditional clinical with mannequin based. And now you hear, well, we can't replace mannequin based with online. And it's like, well, why not? You know, if we're doing it well and you're meeting the learning outcomes, you know, I think there's a place for everything, right? My colleagues and I did two systematic reviews over this COVID period, and looking at outcomes of traditional clinical education, which is always considered the gold standard, right, for nursing. But the quantitative review was deemed an empty review because we found nothing, no research to support outcomes in the type of education that we've been doing for decades, right?
I was going to ask you about that. What can you talk a little bit about that? It was a really interesting
piece. It was fascinating, and it was completely unexpected. And usually when you have an empty review, it's because your topic is too new and you don't have a research base behind it, or your research question is so narrowly focused that you're not going to find anything. So in our review, we did not put a limit on the years. So it was literature from any time. And we used 43 search terms, which I think supports the fact that the question was not too narrow. Part of the reason is because we used every single word we had ever used clinical called. And, you know, as we read through systematic reviews, I mean, clinical is called a lot of different things. So we included them all because we really wanted to see what was out there. And it wasn't until we were pretty close to the end that we're like, oh my gosh, there is nothing here. There's nothing. So then we thought, okay, well, let's do a qualitative review. That's probably where it's at. Let's look at the qualitative literature. So our exclusion criteria for that one, we used the exact same search terms. So we designed it the same way, but we excluded perceptions, student perceptions. We wanted what was the learning. And we ended that one with six different papers, six different research studies, but they all were completely different things. Like one was outcomes from a nurse-run clinic. One was outcomes from working the night shift. One was outcomes from working in another country. And so we couldn't draw any generalizations from that either. So when people say to us, you know, well, traditional clinical is the gold standard, of course they need to have X number of hours in traditional clinical, we can just look at them and say, well, why? What is it that they're learning in X number of hours? Wouldn't it be better if they had this experience and that experience and this other experience instead of 8 hours in a particular day where we're not documenting that they have any learning outcomes? Yeah, that was really, really an interesting and thought-provoking find. And then we talked with Patricia Sharpneck and her colleague, who's, I'm so sorry, her name's escaping me now, but they do work each year with the problem-based, is it PBDS? Problem-based system. Well, anyway, they publish this data every year on readiness to practice. And the percentage of new grads that are, they're ready to practice out of school goes down every year. And so last year it was down to 7%. So if only 7% of the nursing graduates are ready for practice, and we have no documentation that how we're teaching them does any good, then we have to really, really look at what we're doing and make some changes. So it's been fun to be a part of this. I feel like we have the potential to make a difference, but it's a huge, huge undertaking. So we'll see where that heads.
Wow. Well, Kim, I think we're going to conclude this here unless you have any closing thoughts that you want to share with us. I'm eternally grateful for this opportunity. You're a wealth of resources. Do you want to talk a little bit about where people can get information about your websites and some things like that?
Yeah, sure. So I created a website about almost 4 years ago because, you know, when you look at manuscripts and journals, it will tell you about how the tool was developed and the reliability and validity of it. But the tools themselves aren't normally published along with that. And so I was getting a lot of requests for it for different tools. And I thought, well, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be an easier way. So I created my first and only website, and it's designed so that there's a page for each evaluation tool that I've created alone or with colleagues, as well as a few other tools that have established reliability and validity. And each page tells you, you know, why the tool was developed, how it was developed, how to use it, how to score it, that type of thing. And then you can just go and fill out a very short request form, and then it will automatically link you to a download of the document. And in some cases, there's also some tools there that you can use to help establish inter-rater reliability amongst your staff, if it's or your faculty, if it's a rubric. So it's the website is called Evaluating Healthcare Simulation, and it's sim-eval.org. Very short, sim-eval.org. It is a Google site, and sometimes people are blocked from Google sites at work. So if it doesn't work at home or at work, just do it at home. But yeah, it has reached, what did I say, 82 different countries, and it's had several thousand unique downloads because I take all the duplicates out of my database. But that amazes me because the only place really that I've posted anything about this website is on LinkedIn. So I'm glad because it does show that it was needed, that we have that far of a reach. But wow, 82 countries. It's crazy.
Thank you so much, Kim.
Welcome. Thanks for asking me, Deb. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks again to Iris Health Solutions Limited for sponsoring this week's podcast. Iris Health Solutions Limited makes co-designing, sharing, and creating sim scenarios quick and easy. Thanks for joining us here at the Sim Cafe. We hope you enjoyed. Visit us at www.innovativesimsolutions.com. And be sure to hit that like and subscribe button so you never miss an episode. Innovative Sim Solutions is your one-stop shop for your simulation needs. A turnkey solution.